Well, before we get started for this session, I thought that I'd take a moment. I do this at all of the conferences, or have for the last several years, just to talk a little bit about books. Most of you have made your way through the line over here at the book table, but it's really an incredible resource. It's rare that you can find so many good books in one place. And you certainly are going to have a difficult time finding very many bookstores or even church book tables anywhere in the country as well stocked as these tables. So avail yourselves of this opportunity. Augustine, the great saint of Northern Africa and father of Protestantism and Western civilization, once said, "Books are a delight at home, no hindrance abroad, companions at night. In traveling in the country, indeed, no wise man ought ever be found apart from their company." Books are a great resource, and they provide a continual conversation between ourselves and the wisest and the greatest men and women of the ages. So I want to just talk about a few of the books that are on the table. You probably know about the Henty books and are already familiar with some of them. The Henty books were originally written at the end of the Victorian age for young boys, adventure stories to make history come alive. They are, though, incredibly well-researched, incredibly accurate, lots of fun to read, and now, since our educational standards have changed so dramatically, what were once books for boys, 10, 11, and 12-year-olds, are now well above college reading level. There are two books up here that are, I think, new today. I don't think these were up previously. And in fact, I know that Pastor Snap has told me that several other shipments are coming in. For instance, the book that I mentioned last night, Scott's Worthies, should be on the table tomorrow. But I don't believe these books were on yesterday. And these are both wonderful books. This one is by Joey Piper, called The Lord's Day, and it addresses one of the most pertinent questions in the Reformed world today, the abandonment of the honoring of the Lord's Day. And it's quite good, very useful, very practical. Joey Piper is a very practical writer, but a writer of great substance. Also, with my dear friend David Hall, Joey Piper has edited a book dealing with the controversy surrounding the creation narrative in the book of Genesis and the whole issue of the framework hypothesis. If you've heard that language, there's a very potent question right now in a number of theological circles. This is a very helpful anthology that deals with that question. Many of you know of the legacy of Greg Bahnsen and of Cornelius Van Til. This is a wonderful anthology that captures the best of both. And this is a series of readings in Van Til, a presuppositional apologist who taught at Westminster Seminary throughout most of middle and latter half of the 20th century. It's also a wonderful introduction to systemizing Van Til's thought as organized by one of his most esteemed and brilliant disciples, Greg Bahnsen. This is a great place to start. If you've never read Van Til, you need to. But if you've never read Van Til, you probably will have a difficult time of it if you go anywhere else besides this particular volume. This is the best single introduction. John Frame has also written a fine book on Van Til, but this is the place to start. This is a wonderful reprint of a great old classic. It's a wonderful reprint in that the binding is wonderful, the packaging is wonderful, the paper is wonderful, the ink is wonderful. It's got acid-free paper, very pleasant typesetting, and you need that for a book like this. It's kind of like I teach classes on reading. Some books really need to be read in a medium that is conducive to the actual message. Medium and message are never separate, as Pastor Schlissel was pointing out in relation to culture just a moment ago. Medium and message go together. And this is a difficult book to read in that it's Governor Bradford's account of the planting of Plymouth Plantation and the work of God's good providence in the midst of the people who pioneered that American settlement. It's difficult reading in some ways, but it is so rich. If you want to accomplish anything, whether it's with your body or your mind or your career, your aspirations in any area, you're going to have to work. And this is the best single format that I've ever seen this volume in, besides the 1828 Harper version, which is a little difficult to find these days. Now, this is a wonderful history of the United States written by the former Vice President of the Confederacy, Alexander Stephens, a man who was... He was a remarkable scholar. He was constantly at odds with the Confederate government over issues of principle, though he was always esteemed as one of the greatest leaders in American history. He was, interestingly, a close friend early on with the revolutionary Abraham Lincoln in 1848, when Lincoln was first in Congress and was pronouncing from the floor of the House his support of Marx and Engels' revolution of 1848 in Europe. Alexander Stephens was patiently instructing him in the issues of Christ and covenant. And the fruit of Stephens' seeds were born late in Lincoln's life, alas, way too late, But it was a remarkable man and the remarkable providence of God to bring those two together. I talk about it a little bit in my book, Best Friends. But this was the fruit of Stephen's labors after the war. And it provides a really wonderful account of the founding of the country, a very covenantal perspective of the conflicts that ultimately arose, and the resolution of those conflicts, however painful and difficult. This is an entirely different sort of book. Suzanne Clark is a wonderful poet. And this book, Sketches of Home, is a book that has contained within delightful verse profound social commentary. It is a critique of our whole American pop culture attitude. It is a call, a beckoning to the things that matter most. And it's done in a powerful and beautiful fashion. This is a book that particularly every man should read. Because women will be attracted to it naturally. Partly this cutesy purple cover. With a nice little cottage garden and the dove that's flittering off into the sunset and the soft focus shot of the cottage. But it's a reminder to men that home is where we belong. It's a reminder to us that the things that matter most are not our portfolios or our resumes, but our wives and our children and the daily lives that surround us and the calling to hearth and home and garden and life. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. And, though I've not read it, I see that over here on the literature table, which you should peruse carefully because there are a lot of things over on the free literature table that you should have, but I see on the literature table that she's got a second volume that is now about to come out with a pre-pub offer of saving $3 from the Sow's Ear Press. Her new book, Sunday Service at the Home for Incurables. That sounds enticing. I'm going to immediately send off my coupon and buy it, and I encourage you to as well. And don't miss the copy of the Chalcedon Report that Steve Schlissel pointed out. Great articles. For those of you who are wrestling with issues of politics, for instance, fundamental stuff in here, pointing out the rise and ultimately the stall of the religious right, and what our attitude as Christians ought to be about that. What lies behind the failure of, for instance, Republicans to have any more sturdy backbone than a jellyfish, and why evangelicals are so quick to fall in line with such bibble babble and such, as I said before, super califatalistic existential atrocious nonsense. Otto Scott's newsletter is something that I read every single month. There's a brochure about it, and you'll see endorsements from such folks as Howard Phillips, who you're going to be tantalized by later on in this conference. Also, Pastor Snapp's publication, The Presbyterian Witness, it is very helpful in keeping abreast of not only great books, Byron Snapp's book reviews are always incredibly helpful, but in addition to that, it keeps you abreast of what's going on in the front lines of theological controversy, the stuff that's normally whispered about only in session meetings is brought into the light of day by the Presbyterian Witness, and as well, issues of cultural currency. Very important stuff. And then finally, my own newsletter is out there, and the reading program that goes with it. If you've ever thought, I ought to read the classics, but I don't know where to start, well, it tells you where to start. And then brochures on Bannockburn College. Make sure that you take opportunity to talk to the folks who are representing Bannockburn College and Christ College and explore the possibilities that those may hold. Both schools have one-year programs, so if you're committed to going off and getting an engineering degree, you can also get a foundational Christian worldview. Both of those schools, New St. Andrews, make sure you pick up the information and find out about the Dabney Theological Center. This stuff is rich stuff, and there are very few places where you can come and gather all of this information from all of these great institutions, organizations, and see it all in one place and have it make sense in a cohesive worldview. Talk to Pastor Schlissel about urban nations. Make sure you find out about Frontline Fellowship. This is important stuff, great works. If you feel like you're in a desert where you are, or an isolated little island, here is a way for you to be encouraged, equipped, motivated, and sent. Okay, commercial break over. Although, commercial breaks are kind of fun. I mean, Super Bowls are oftentimes really stupid. But the commercials... In this hour, we're going to take a look at one of the most influential lives of the 19th century, one of the most influential Reformed thinkers, a man whose prescient thought and powerful proclamations of the gospel are as applicable today as they were in his own more than 150 years ago. Thomas Chalmers was born in Anstruther, a little Fifeshire town just to the east of where Edinburgh and the capital is, a kind of rural section. He was raised in a stalwart Covenanter home, strong Calvinistic conventions, were imposed upon him and his 8 brothers and 5 sisters from their earliest days. Jarmer's father was a man who believed that it was his responsibility to train up the children of the covenant, to provide for them not only strong theological foundations, but to encourage in them a substantive transformation through the practical applications of orthodoxy. In other words, he believed that it was just as important for a family to be committed to orthopraxy as orthodoxy, the putting into deeds the words of the living God. And so early on, young Thomas was given a sweet taste of the fullness of Christian culture. And he demonstrated a kind of a prodigy early on. He was prodigious in his abilities and talents, so that by the time he was 11 years old, just before his 12th birthday, he had exhausted the resources of the little town of Anster and was sent on to St. Andrew's University to enroll in the math curriculum, 11 years old. Now, that was not entirely unprecedented. There had been one other student at the age of 11 to enter St. Andrew's. Nevertheless, it was a bit extraordinary. And he proved himself to be a precocious student, much more interested in ball games than he was in his studies, and yet nevertheless maintaining a 4.0 average from the age of 11. He entered the university in 1792. By 1795, because of the influence of his reading of Jonathan Edwards, he felt enticed to at least begin taking some courses in the divinity school. And so in 1795, he enrolled in the divinity curriculum and quickly determined that he would have a career in the church. Well, the thing that we should understand is that by 1792, some 50 years following the rising of Bonnie Prince Charlie and the squashing and the disruption of the Celtic culture in Scotland, St. Andrews had become a bastion of what was then called moderatism. Moderatism was essentially the old Calvinistic faith of Scotland intermingled with rationalistic and Enlightenment thought. So what Chalmers was receiving at the School of Divinity was not the fiery gospel of Knox. He was not receiving the kinds of things that Robert Campbell might have dispensed in the early days when St. Andrews was the bastion of biblical orthodoxy and of covenanter zeal. Instead, Chalmers was getting a kind of moderate version of the gospel that said that the gospel needed to accommodate itself to the needs of current circumstances and situations, that the language of the gospel needed to be accommodated to the vernacular of the day, that in order to be relevant, that the church needed to change some of its antiquarian ways, its moss-backed attitudes, particularly in the area of the intellect. Now, these were the days prior to Darwin, but nevertheless, days of skepticism and examination of the rationalistic impulse of Hume and Smith and others. And so in the School of Divinity, in a sense, Chalmers had his faith shipwrecked. But while his faith was shipwrecked, his ambitions, because of the humanistic impulse and the idea of natural progress, those Enlightenment ideas that put man at the center of all things and the accomplishment of a perfected new world order at the top of the agenda sheet, because of that, Chalmers became a very ambitious young man. And because of his prodigious talents, he was slated early on for great achievement, but his faith was in utter shambles. It was little more than window dressing to his life. The worship of Jesus Christ did not affect what he thought about mathematics. Mathematics affected what he thought about the lordship of Jesus Christ. The traditions of the covenanters did not shape his worldview. His worldview shaped his perception of the covenanters. He accommodated himself to modern times and modern circumstances because, after all, if modern people were to be reached with the gospel in any sort of relevant way, then we need to make sure that we're speaking a language that people can understand. We're singing hymns that they can relate to and actually sing. We need to create services that are compelling, enticing, that will invite people in, that will be accessible, that will be seeker friendly. Now, these were all the things that he was taught at St. Andrews, the heart and soul of Scottish moderatism. Well, as a theologian and a mathematician, Chalmers very quickly began to pursue a course that was not at all uncommon for moderates in the church in that day, and that was to have a duality of purposes, or what was then called a plurality of vocations. Meaning that he would receive, upon graduation and ordination, a small rural parish from which he would get his living. And he would preach there on Sundays, but little more. He would be a preaching pastor. And the rest of the week, he would devote to his studies, to the exploration of science. He was a great chemist, a burgeoning astronomer, and a math tutor now at St. Andrews University. So he'd pursue his ambitions and allow the church to just kind of, you know, foot the bill. And while he would not neglect his pulpit duties, his pulpit became essentially an experimenting ground for his new ideas. The very little of the gospel, oftentimes the scripture of the day, would be little more than a springboard into a discussion of the latest theories of political economy. But of course, this was relevant. He was dealing with issues that people were wrestling with every day. Seven things to do to help build self-esteem. You know, that kind of stuff. Five reasons why the intellect matters in these days of rationalistic progress. Well, he continued on this course and ultimately was, because of his prodigious gifts, he was actually ordained 2 years prior to what the Book of Church Order allowed, and was placed in his first parish in 1799, a little five-shire town called Kilmeny, just about 15 miles from St. Andrews. Spent most of his time at St. Andrews and paid little heed to the flock at Kilmeny. But in 1809, just 10 years later, as he was pursuing his career and gaining renown as a math tutor, chemistry tutor at Edinburgh, a very articulate spokesperson for a new vision of Whig political economy. In 1809, he suffered a series of setbacks. Two of his siblings died, a sister and a brother, after long illnesses. And then he himself protracted a terrible lung infection that brought him to the place of despairing of his life. During his long infirmity, which lasted over the entire winter of 1809 and into the spring of 1810, he was wrestling suddenly with ultimate questions. Questions like, what is the gospel for, and how does God speak? And he even began to wrestle as a mathematician with the issue of proportions, realizing that he had been all out of proportion in his estimation of his time in light of his estimation of eternity. It was almost as if God spoke to him through a mathematical equation and said, your proportions are all out of line, and you fixated on an unrealistic goal. It brought him to a place of utter and complete despair of his own ability to make his way in the world, to accomplish anything worthwhile, to save himself. And after having been a pastor for 10 years, one of the most prodigious scholars that St. Andrews had ever produced, a great spokesman for plurality, a national icon for intellectual plurality, suddenly he was converted, and radically converted. As he recovered, parishioners said there is something transformational that is evident in Chalmers' life. The first Sunday that he was back in the pulpit, he preached the gospel in a way that he had never heard it, much less preached it. The congregation was stricken in heart. And over the next several months and over the next 5 years, he began to build a parish ministry the likes of which Scotland had not seen since the days of the Covenanters. People thronged from as far away as Edinburgh and Aberdeen just to hear the man open the Word of God. And he had become this amazing orator who was able to take the profoundest theological truths and apply them to the toughest of practical questions with the loftiest of language and the most beautiful illustrations, so that people were oftentimes... before he began to get national attention and quickly became the leader of what was then called the evangelical wing of the Church of Scotland. But he was not content with simply great oratory in the pulpit. He threw himself passionately into the carousels. At one time, prior to the disruption and the dismantling of the Celtic social structure, the parish had been the heart and the soul of Scotland. It was the basis of the whole fabric of the civilization, now unraveled. And Chalmers set about the task of rebuilding it right there in Kilmeny. He established schools. He set up a whole new standard for the care of the poor and the brokenhearted and dispossessed, the widows and the orphans in their distress, and made that a central aspect of his ministry. He started missionary societies. Among the first missionary societies in Scotland, the first societies for the propagation of the Scriptures, the first Bible societies, the first mission-sending societies, all in this tiny little Fife Shire parish. Before long, obviously, there were large churches clamoring for such a preacher as this. And after much prayer and struggle, just days after news of the great victory of the British at Waterloo in 1815, Chalmers accepted a call to the Tron Church in Glasgow, one of the most prominent churches in all of Scotland, if not the most prominent church in all of Scotland at this time. The rich parish, the heart of the urban center, and a thriving industrial town. But Chalmers saw it as an opportunity to take his ideas of the restoration of parish and apply them to an urban center, to restore the parish ideal with a school and care for the poor and culture, all developed growing out of the life of a local church. And he saw this as an opportunity to replicate that in an urban Negev, a wasteland. And so he went to the Tron Church in 1815 and was an instant success. People thronged the churches. In those days, you actually had to pay rent on pews. And the elders of the church raised the rents of the Tron Church pews 4 times in the first 5 months. And without any trouble whatsoever, they were able to obtain these pew rents. Chalmers was disturbed by this because what it ultimately meant was that nobody could come to his church except the rich. And so just 5 months into his tenure, he began an evening service in which there were no pew rents whatsoever, but anyone who had a pew rent in the earlier services of the day would not be allowed. In other words, he threw the doors open to the poor, to the street people, to the workers and the smutty sorts of industries that then crowded the lanes of Glasgow. He threw the doors of the church open, the most prominent church in Glasgow, the most prominent preacher in Scotland, perhaps the most prominent preacher in all of Great Britain, for the unloved and the unlovely. It was revolutionary. Out of that grew a series of social ministries that challenged the poor laws. He began a process of visiting all of the neighborhoods. He believed that a parish life should build real community and that it ought to be somewhat geographical. Again, quite revolutionary. In 1816, he held a series of businessmen lunch lectures there at the Tron Church, in which he lectured on the proofs of Christianity from astronomy. Now, taking the discipline of astronomy, which was then the seedbed of great skepticism, the beginning of the great divorce between science and the scriptures. And the lectures were thronged by crowds. It was estimated that 3 times as many people who wanted to get in were turned away each day as he gave these lectures. The lectures were ultimately bound together as a book called Astronomical Lectures, cleverly. And it quickly became the best-selling book in the world. Outsold Sir Walter Scott. Outsold Jane Austen. It became a benchmark for publishing success. The first day the book was out, it sold out in just 1 hour in the London bookshops. Suddenly, God was giving him a megaphone to speak the truth of Christianity into the life of a Scotland and an England that had utterly and completely forgotten the truth. The frustrations, though, quickly followed all of these successes. The elders, the session, even the town council began to see that Chalmers was a tourist attraction. They could make hay with this. They wanted to expand the Tron Church. Chalmers said, "It's already too big. How can I pastor a throng? Well, you can't pastor in a mega context. You can talk at people. You can preach at people. You can publish best-selling books. But that's not ministry. That's not a parish. That's not what a church looks like. That's not how you disciple children. That's no atmosphere for me to raise my children in, to allow my wife to be lost in. I'm not a celebrity. I'm a pastor." So ultimately, with the permission of the town council, Chalmers resigned from the pulpit of the Tron Church and determined to build a new church, establish a new parish in the poorest section of Glasgow. And thus, 4 years later, in 1819, began the work of St. John's. St. John's was built upon the assumption that church planting is the best approach to church growth. The idea was that people need to be pastored. They don't need to be entertained. People need to be pastored. They don't need to be herded. People need to to be trained, to do the work of the ministry, to be able to disciple their own children. They need to know and be known. There needs to be an accountability. People need to be responsible for folks and accountable to folks. Chalmers was attempting to recapture that Celtic knot in the midst of an urban environment. I mean, he's not out in the pastoral realms of Fifeshire any longer. He's not over there at Anstor or Kilmeny. He's in the heart of the Industrial Revolution, a dark and dingy town of industrial efficiency, and yet he was calling the church back to the ideal of locality and the care and cure of souls. It was a remarkable success. St. John's became a model church and became the basis for what Chalmers called parish replication. The planting of new churches all over the countryside and in the urban areas. What Chalmers was after was what he called the godly commonwealth. The transformation of the culture by the realization of the covenant in the church. He believed that, as Henry Van Til said, that culture is merely religion externalized. Therefore, it was essential that in the incubator, the greenhouse, the seedbed of the faith, the parish, that orthodoxy and orthopraxy be done. Inculcated, nurtured, vivified. And so St. John's became a model for all of Scotland. In 1823, his old alma mater, St. Andrew's University, which had declined by this time to a little less than 200 students, because moderatism does not exactly excite the idea of training for a ministry which is really little more than window dressing for cultural endeavors, for moral majorities or Christian coalitions or whatever. Obviously, that's not particularly enticing because it's not particularly effective. And so what happened was that the university just declined and became ever more strident in its moderatism and ever more influential in gaining access to the organs of influence in the society. Amazingly, it was this declining, decrepit university that had control of all of the great journals and newspapers and thus continued to churn out this ineffective rubbish. But now they were in a bind, and the trustees decided that if they could get Chalmers, it would be a great meal ticket for the old university. He was an alumni. He would be, in a sense, coming home to Fifeshire, and it would be a match made in heaven. And they could ignore some of his eccentricities about his theology and his orthodoxy and all this passion for the poor and all of this business of church planting. And in some ways, they would be doing the church a good service because they'd get him out of the pulpit for a change. So they offered him the chair of the Department of Moral Philosophy. They came in 1823 to St. Andrews and became the professor of moral philosophy there. In 1824, the enrollment of St. Andrews more than doubled just because Chalmers was there. The year after that, it more than doubled again just because Chalmers was there. The year after that, it tripled just because Chalmers was there. The faculty, of course, hated him. They couldn't stand the guy. And the stories were told of that he would come into faculty meetings and the room would clear. Nobody wanted to talk to him. It's interesting, the second day that Chalmers arrived in St. Andrews, he went out on a little walking tour and invited a number of street urchins into his home, and he began a Bible club. Second day that he was there. Third day that he was there, he began to hold evangelical training services for a number of students who were new in town and were interested in the ideas of church planting and of parish relief and of parish development. Soon there was a circle of young students surrounding Chalmers wherever he went. They actually had to knock out four walls in the old classroom annex building just to contain the crowds who came to hear Chalmers' lectures. He was articulate. He was passionate. He was funny. Students loved him because he was very personal. He would have them in their homes. He was almost everything that you would dream of for a college professor. Almost immediately, students began to catch the vision of what this might look like if this sort of church were to expand around the globe. And for the first time, a real missionary movement began in Scotland. The first seven foreign missionaries that Scotland sent out since before the time of the Covenanters were all students of Chalmers at St. Andrews. In fact, the story is told in the St. Andrews 7, the book that I mentioned yesterday. Great missionary movement that grew out of that. New Bible societies. A whole transformation of evangelism in what was then the Crown Colony of India. People like Alexander Duff grew up under his tutelage, and suddenly the attack was on. The moderates went into a frenzy and tried to discredit everything that Chalmers was doing. Chalmers believed that effective covenantal churches will be passionate in their preaching, practical in their pastoral care, and full of missionary zeal. He believed that a part of the curriculum of every university student ought to be not only the benchmarks of academia, but also practical service. Every single one of his students was assigned a role in mercy ministry, in evangelistic ministry in the town among the poor and the despised. In the first 4 years that he was in St. Andrews, they were able to receive permission from the presbytery to start 18 new churches just right in the region. Chalmers argued that it was ridiculous that students came to a university to study divinity and never practiced it. Here were these divinity students high up in their ivory tower, and they never talked to anybody about Christ. They had all these highfalutin ideas in their minds, but they never put them into practice. He believed that it was horrific that the church had descended to such a level. And the idea that the church should be accessible and practical and easy for the unbeliever seemed to him to be the height of compromise. Ultimately, Chalmers was miserable in St. Andrews, and ultimately even hounded out of town by the moderates. He was offered in 1828 the chair of divinity at the University of Edinburgh, and he took it. Once again, throngs came to his lectures. Once again, he came into conflict with the moderates. And once again, he held up a standard that students thronged to. He had two pet projects as he undertook his work at the School of Divinity in Edinburgh. Besides his normal activities of planting churches and going to the poor and fellowshipping with and living with them, his two pet projects were to teach his students to, as he said, always hold suspect that which is popular. Always hold suspect that which is popular. He believed that was ultimately the enemy of Christianity. It accommodated itself especially well in moderate circles. Moderates loved to gobble up the seemingly innocent aspects of pop culture because it made them seem like normal folks. It enabled them to fit in. So they would accommodate themselves to the style and to the substance of the culture that was around them. The second thing that that Chalmers worked with his students in dealing with was what he called the atomization of modern life. Meaning the gross emphasis on individualism and individuality. The desire to do what I want. Make my decisions. Disrupt the patterns of authority and accountability and responsibility that always mark true Christian culture. And Chalmers made this a point of substance in all of his teaching and all of his discipling. Alas, the conflict between the moderates and the whole philosophy of moderatism, with its attempt to accommodate itself to popular culture and make itself accessible to popular culture, and the old stalwarts led by Chalmers, came into a great conflict between 1833 and 1843, often called in the history books, the church history books, the 10 years conflict. It was a struggle for the soul of the Church of Scotland. The moderates, who were really just liberals, but who painted themselves as calm and thoughtful and pleasant and nice, always trying to make peace and just be available for folks without getting all radical and extremist and bent out of shape. They seemed to be so nice. So Chalmers preached a great sermon called The Heresy of Nice. Jesus came, he said, to give us good news, not nice news. Now sometimes nice, he said, is just promiscuous. You go around and love whatever. Love a pig's snout. Love a perverse heresy. Love it into the kingdom. He was considered extremist, harsh, hostile. He was somehow not compassionate and insensitive and, oh Lord help us, intolerant. Next Sunday, Chalmers preached another sermon called The Duty of Intolerance. And he stood before his congregation and he said, I will never make apology for being intolerant of those things that God is intolerant of. I will never make apology for the accommodation of sin, wickedness, perversity, idolatry. And if moderatism is the path to the accommodation of my heart to those things, I must purge my heart. Even at the risk of my own reputation. Chalmers put everything on the line. He was a best-selling author. He was the best-known professor and lecturer, the most esteemed preacher in all of Great Britain. He was the counselor to princes and prime ministers. And yet he was willing to give it all up. In fact, he sought ways to give it all up his entire life for the sake of the gospel. Alas, his most valiant efforts failed to preserve the integrity of the church, and in 1843, the great disruption occurred. In the midst of the General Assembly, when an impasse occurred and it was evident that the government was not going to allow the church to have its independence and the moderates were going to accommodate themselves to the acculturated norms of the day, Chalmers walked out of the General Assembly, renounced his standing in his presbytery, at the university, in the church, and half of those assembled there marched out with him. These men were leaving behind their jobs, their livelihoods, most of them their homes. They had no future and no security, but they had Chalmers. And they marched out into the St. James Square, not knowing what the future would hold. Chalmers, by this time in his 60s, worn out by his labors, looking forward to retirement, went into a frenzy of activity. Over the next few years, in the 5 years that remained of his life, Chalmers was responsible for planting 700 new parishes all over Scotland. The establishment of 420 parish schools. He was responsible for the establishment of a brand new theological school, New College Edinburgh, to train those who would go on into the ministry. The establishment of a new missionary society and two new Bible societies. These churches were not only established, but he raised the money to build them. When at last his earthly work was done, he went home to be with the Lord on May the 30th, 1847. All of Great Britain was pierced through. It was said that no king had ever received such accolades as Chalmers. No king's funeral had ever provoked such open grieving. The 5 miles between the church and the burial ground were thronged with almost 500,000 souls, the poor and the rich alike, grieving for the loss of this man who had stood for truth at all costs, who had lost everything in the process and yet totally transformed Scotland, reinvented the parish system, reasserted the importance of education at the heart of the discipling process, reinvigorated the notion of pastoral care, the one-on-one discipleship, retying the old Celtic knot. Amazingly, Chalmers' influence was not limited to Scotland, though. Obviously, with all of the connections with the American church, and particularly the American Presbyterian Church, the struggles, the theological struggles that were occurring in Scotland were closely watched by the Americans. And the whole history of the old school, old light, new light, the whole history of the struggle for the heart and soul of the covenanting churches and the faithful Orthodox Presbyterian churches needs to be read in the light of and through the lens of the great disruption in Scotland. Because the stalwarts here in America who were struggling for the souls of their own denominations often used the language and took the path of Chalmers in their great warfare. Chalmers, perhaps his most famous sermon, was a sermon entitled "The Expulsive Power of a New Affection." In this sermon, Chalmers reflected on the fact that in his lifetime he had seen the Jacobin Revolution of France, the rise and the demise of Napoleon, the insurgent communist movement under Marx and Engels, He argued that moderatism was the gateway for revolution. That moderatism, in a sense, tore down the walls of the great antithesis between the Christian worldview and paganism. And that when the wall is torn down, because moderatism does not like distinctions, doesn't like litmus tests, doesn't like hard lines, doesn't like law, doesn't like justice, because of that, the revolutionaries are able to rush in across the border and capture every stronghold. But the gospel, he said, has this expulsive power. Not at all unlike the expulsive power that grips our hearts anytime we fall under the sway of a new affection. What does a young man in love think about? What's in his heart? He can't think of anything except her hair, her eyes, the sound of her voice, oh, the touch of her hand, oh, the swish of her skirt, oh, her silhouette at sunset. It's the expulsive power of a new affection. Everything else ceases to matter. What Chalmers said was that when we come to believe the gospel, the expulsive power of a new affection makes no room for accommodation. It makes no room for compromise. It makes no room for a love affair with the world, a love affair with money, with being tragically hip and terminally cool. The explosive power of the new affection pushes everything out of our hearts except that which is good and right and just and true and beautiful. Except the gospel itself. Chalmers believed that until the church was gripped by the expulsive power of the new affection, we would constantly be tinkering with and toying with disaster. That however much our good intentions may be established, however much we may justify our peddling with worldly things, we will have torn down the wall and allowed the horde across the threshold. His vision was so prophetic. He understood the dangers of the megachurch. He understood the dangers of the seeker-sensitive church. He understood the dangers of creating a celebrity system in the evangelical world. He understood the dangers of accommodating ourselves to peculiar ideas that are the currency of the day. He understood the dangers of falling into lockstep with a fashion fascist of his day or our day. And he stood forthrightly at the threshold of his culture with the expulsive power of the new affection in his heart. And he said not only no to the things of the world, but he said yes to the fullness of the gospel and the culture that it inculcates. He reinvented the very fabric of civilization. For 75 years afterwards, until once again the Scottish church capitulated to the norms of the day, the Scottish church adopted his parish ideal. In Glasgow, a city that prior to Chalmers' ministry, there was a massive social welfare program to take care of the indigents and the homeless, the widows and the orphans and their distress. 20 years later, there was no social welfare system in Scotland at all. The government was put out of business because the church did its business. Scotland had the most highly educated citizenry in the world. Almost 100% literacy. And there were no public schools because the church did its job. Because families were trained. Because fathers stood in their households and called his covenant children to faithfulness. And he did it not in some long ago, far away, pastoral scene that was hopelessly agrarian and marvelously pastoral. Instead, he did it in the heart of the city, in the midst of the disruptions of the Industrial Revolution. What a prophet for our own day. What a vision for action. What a purposeful model. The explosive power of the new affection is no less needed in this day as it was in his. To expel from our heart evangelinity, that kind of serenity-based evangelicalism that is focused on me and my needs and my wants. To expel the notions of eschatological whoopee cushion, goose us into a real good, feel good approach. Ecclesiastical Disneyland, where we can take our little joy rides through the emotional stratosphere. Where we can sing our little Jesus nursery rhymes, where we can build our palatial Jesus-sized exercise room. How absurd can we get? Churches with snack bars called the Garden of Eden. Christian bookstores that sell marvelous Victoria's Secret ripoffs with Bible verses placed in interesting places. Thou art my hiding place and such things. Is this what we've descended to? It is, isn't it? Has Christianity just become another version of mind candy for us? God help us! May we cry out and yearn for the explosive power of a new affection. Oh, Lord Jesus, I thank you for your mercies in preserving us to this day. I thank you for this covenant remnant, and I pray that you would call them to Chalmers-like valor in the days to come. So we pray this in the great name of Jesus, our Savior. May he purge our hearts. Amen.